We started just before the exam two, really three different types of material. We talked about cationic reactions of carbonyls, so we made hemiketals, hemiacetals, ketals, and acetals. We started working on anionic reactions, so we got that all-important Grignard reaction, which next week we're certainly going to be doing a lot more with. But I think in this section we also had started working on protecting groups, hadn't we? We did, didn't we? Yes. Do we remember that we covered protecting groups, or that that all just got erased by the fact that you had the exam? Maybe we should start over with the idea of a protecting group event again, shall we? Let's do an example then. Because I think the example I did in class was taking a difunctional molecule like this, something that had both a ketone and alkyl halide on it, and I said that I wanted to make a Grignard reagent from it. Now, what would be the difficulty or the problem, though, with trying to make a Grignard reagent out of that? Well, what reagents would I use to make the Grignard reagent out of this? It wasn't on the exam, so you've got to go over the weekend and catch up again. Magnesium. It's magnesium metal, and on top of that, you need one of two solvents, either diethyl ether or THF, which we covered what THF is, didn't we? Tetrahydrofuran. The reason you need one of those two solvents is that oxygen complexes with the magnesium intermediates as they form, and if you don't have that complexation occur, you're not able to make the Grignard reagent. So anytime that you're making one, yes, it's magnesium metal, but you always need to show one of those two solvents. And diethyl ether tends to be the more common one, so that's the one I'm going to show here. This works on paper, but doesn't work in real life because Grignard reagents react with ketones. You have a ketone on the exact same molecule, so it won't be able necessarily to wrap around and make a two-membered ring with itself, but you could have one molecule of this reagent attack another. So you wouldn't, at the very least, you would not be able to react it with some other aldehyde or ketone that you might want it to. And so the idea behind protecting groups is that we want to have some way of temporarily masking the carbonyl functionality. We don't want to totally destroy the carbonyl, because we might want that back later. But we want to hide the fact it's a carbonyl, so we could make this Grignard reagent. And if we make this, we somehow mask this, we want to be able to unmask it as well. That's another important aspect about protecting groups. Well, we have the perfect thing available to make a ketal out of it. Because a ketal is a reversible reaction. Making a ketal is reversible. And ketals are sensitive to acid, but they're not so sensitive to base. Because if you think about what a ketal really is, it's like an ether. Ethers normally aren't leaving groups. So you make the ketal, and it protects it from to a large extent, from bases. And so that's what we're going to do. Now, there are many alcohols that easily could be used to make a ketal. I tend to use this diol only because it makes a very convenient five-membered ring. So it's a common trick often used. Need a little acid source in there as well. So a couple of cycles of protonate open attack, deprotonate later, and we end up with the protected carbonyl. So this is the protect step here. We could then do the formation of a Grignard reagent, magnesium in ether. We could then throw some other aldehyde or ketone at it to react. In this case, I'll use ethanol. Make sure you don't do what I almost did and put the wrong number of carbons in. Initially, we have an alkoxide, because Grignard reaction, that's under very basic conditions. So there is a workup step that we need to do. Now, if you're careful about it, if you use dilute acid, you'll be able to neutralize the alkoxide without necessarily affecting the ketal. And you might want to do this in some circumstances if you wanted to perform yet another reaction that you need to hide the carbonyl from. Eventually, once you're done, though, then water and acid will get rid of the ketal, and we can get our product. Thinking of synthesis, let me just go back and highlight the new carbon-carbon bond. And notice that where the new carbon-carbon bond is, if you didn't know the reagents you came from, one or the other two positions of that bond had to have been the carbonyl, because the alcohol gets formed right where the carbonyl gets pushed open. So in the product, where one of those two positions has to be the alcohol. Just something for you to think about when you are working on Grignard reactions in terms of synthesis. So that last step, that's the deprotect step. And this is the kind of reaction I believe that we had covered on Tuesday. But there is one more functional group now I want to show you, a protecting group for alcohols. Now there's several classes of protecting groups. This may be one that's not in your textbook, but as you're going to see, you've already learned the chemistry for this. So reaction-wise, mechanism-wise, this is not much of a stretch, but it is a new tool with which to do more complicated synthesis. Now, before you get too panicked, it's not that every synthesis we do the rest of time is always going to involve protecting groups. They're not all going to be complicated. But this is such an important technique that we are going to cover some examples of it. And so the first protecting group of alcohols I want to show you is called dihydropyran. Now, the other day we talked about the molecule furan, which was a 5-membered ring that had 2 double bonds in it. Pyran is a 6-membered ring that has 2 double bonds in it. If we were to partially hydrogenate it, then the common name for this molecule is dihydropyran, which means add 2 hydrogens. It's the same kind of nomenclature used for tetrahydrofuran. 4 hydrogens being added on. This molecule readily reacts with alcohols, almost even without an acid catalyst, although one is usually thrown in. Let's see how an alcohol would react with this DHP. Well, it essentially would be regular old Markovnikov addition to an alkene, where the alcohol is the nucleophile that gets added in. Well, actually, I should take that word Markovnikov back, because with the oxygen being in this ring, you potentially could have behavior that doesn't match Markovnikov. And why? Well, once the alkene reacts with H+, which is what it would do first, you're going to form a carbocation. Now, even if the lower carbon, the way I've drawn the structure, had another methyl group on there, for example, and so if we made a tertiary position, it's not where the carbocation is going to go. It's always going to go to where the oxygen is. Why? Well, because as soon as you do, that positive charge gets delocalized. And that resonance stabilization is a whole lot more important than just hyperconjugation. This is real conjugation. So that stabilizes it more than even a tertiary position would, so it's always going to go to this oxygen. Part of the reason of pointing that out is next quarter when we work with sugars, we're going to see another reaction in which a neighboring oxygen like that has an influence on the mechanism of a reaction. For this quarter, we can still pretend that really that's just a carbocation, a just special one, and let's say we wanted to throw an alcohol at it. Same type of situation where I'm going to use a difunctional molecule, because as you'll see in a moment, I want to I want to do a Grignard reaction. So the alcohol is going to attack where the carbocation is. Whether you attack the carbocation directly or whether I do it delocalized like I have now, it's really the same thing. So adds in. We temporarily have the oxonium ion that deprotonates. And we end up with this product, which, after you drop once, you can abbreviate. Because if I circled this portion of the structure, what type of functional group would you call that? It's an ether, right? Because we have an oxygen that's got carbons on either side of it. What kind of ether is this specifically? Well, we had pyran, which we didn't use pyran, we used dihydropyran. But notice that during the course of the reaction, we've effectively gotten rid of that other double bond, and so we can call that portion of it tetrahydropyran. So this is known as a tetrahydropyranyl ether, which can be abbreviated like this. Now, if we're trying to do a Grignard reaction, why might we protect an alcohol like this? Well, what would happen if we took that difunctional molecule without the protecting group and tried to react it with something like propyl magnesium bromide? What would be the one and only product that you would result if you had one equivalent of both of those molecules? In other words, react them in one-to-one stoichiometry. What would be the one and only product? Well, two products, really, because you've got two molecules that aren't going to combine. You'll get an alkoxide, that's right. Why? Because pKa of an alcohol is somewhere between 16 and 18. pKa of an alkane is somewhere between 50 and 60. And so even before the carbyl can get attacked, you're going to get an almost instant acid-base reaction. It's generally the case that acid-base reactions are the fastest reactions that are going to happen in solution. So deprotonation will occur, forming an alkoxide. And because we had propyl magnesium bromide, our other product's going to be propane. So Grignard reaction cannot take place in the presence of protic molecules, because otherwise a more rapid acid-base reaction will occur. So that's why we would need, in this example, to protect the alcohol if we really wanted to attack the carbonyl, at least if we wanted to do this cleanly. It is true that it's possible sometimes to force what we want to have happen anyways if we just throw a whole bunch of excess grignard. Because one could imagine that after you deprotonate that alcohol, there's no more alcohol to worry about. So any more grignard reagent you throw at it should go at that carbonyl. And it can work sometimes. But I want to show you a clean technique, because what if your grignard reagent was $1,000 a gram? Then maybe you wouldn't want to throw it around quite so willy-nilly. So we're going to do a protection.
Let me go to a clean page here. Start with that difunctional molecule. React it with DHP. Something else usually thrown in, but I'll tell its story next week. Because I think... Oh, I do have time. I'll still wait till next week. DHP turns this into the THP ether. It's an ether, so it's, again, not a leaving group. Now we could go ahead and throw a grignard reagent at it. Let's say that I threw that same propyl magnesium bromide I wanted to use. Reaction now will be successful. And of course, initially I end up with an alkoxide, which, just to show you the step by step, because at this point I could use just a strong acid source and knock off the THP at the same time I'm going to do protonation. But I want to show it step by step in case you need to do that. So first, dilute acid. To make that, which, let me rewrite. And expand out the abbreviation. Because I misdirected you on purpose earlier. I circled part of the molecule, and you had correctly identified that the molecule is an ether. But what is it really? What functional group is this? How about an acetal? Because you've got two oxygens there, don't you? And they're both connected to a carbon-carbon. And on that common carbon, there's a hydrogen. Aren't all those things exactly the description of what an acetal is? Of course. And so if you threw water and acid at this, you're going to get a couple of cycles of protonate, open attack, deprotonate, pop open the acetal, and release the alcohol. Now, the other section, I didn't write the mechanism out because I didn't have as much time in that class as I did here. I think I'll turn that around. In fact, I'd say I suggest you try this mechanism at home, because if you are looking at past exams, one of the things that really ate their lunch last year was anything that involved a cyclic intermediate. I'll show you what will result from this. Because the more easy thing to determine is that you are going to get the alcohol back, the one that was protected. What other byproduct are you going to end up with? Well, in an acetal or ketal, either one, the position where the two oxygens are connected, that always turns into a carbonyl when it decomposes. So you're going to have a carbonyl at the end of a molecule with a hydrogen there, which means we have an aldehyde. Count carbons over. Aldehyde, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbons, to which is connected an alcohol. And so that is the other product that is spit off. It's a byproduct. We don't care about it. But mechanistically, I want you to be able to go from the THP ether to this final product. So again, I won't answer questions today on the mechanism, but gladly we'll do it Tuesday. So to review, I showed you up above there that you can't do a Grignard reaction if you've got an alcohol around, because you'll just have neutralization. So the clean way to do this reaction is to protect the alcohol. So the DHP step, that is the protect step. Once you're protected, you do the Grignard reaction, work it up, and then you can deprotect. So any questions on this example of an alcohol protecting group? Then let's move on to a slightly different topic. Because before continuing in Grignard reactions, I want to go back to cationic reactions. And I want to talk about nitrogen. Because so far we've done everything with oxygen nucleophiles, those acetals, ketals, hemiacetals, hemiketals. But nitrogen chemistry is pretty common stuff as well. So before we get into the reactions of amines with aldehydes and ketones, let's do just a tiny bit of nomenclature. And then we're going to do, just for the moment, nomenclature of what are known as primary amines, which I'm going to review for all of us what primary means if we're talking about a nitrogenous compound. So this is a three-carbon compound. It would normally be propane. The standardized functional group ending for amine is amine. Really complicated that time. So take propane, stick amine on the end of it, and you get propaneamine. If you add something that was cyclic, cyclohexaneamine. I'm throwing this cyclic example in because it's a reminder to my own self that you don't know how to name aldehydes and ketones that aren't part of the ring but are instead next to the ring. This is something I've got to remember to come back and tackle next week. This is for primary amines, the way we do this nomenclature. And what is a primary amine? Well, for oxygen functional groups, the reactivity of that functional group depends much more on the fact that it's oxygen. Or after that, it depends on how many carbons are attached to the thing the oxygen is attached to. But for nitrogen, its chemistry is a bit different. Nitrogen really is influenced by how many carbons are attached to the nitrogen. Not how many carbons are attached to the same thing the nitrogen is attached to. So a primary amine is this, where you just have one alkyl group on the nitrogen. A secondary amine is where instead you have two groups on the nitrogen. Tertiary, three groups. And then nitrogen, because it's a base. Now, ammonium has a pKb of... Ooh, did I say that wrong in the last class? Oh. Ammonium has a pKa of 9.25, which means ammonia has a pKb of 4.75, which means it's as basic as acetic acid is acidic. So it's a base, which means potentially if I had another alkyl halide, that tertiary amine could do an SN2 reaction, and so we could end up with this. What is known as a
quaternary ammonium salt. And to over-anticipate something we'll talk about in 12C. If you review our SN1 and SN2 notes from last quarter, you could probably count the number of times you saw an amine on no hands. Because amines, because they're basic, aren't good nucleophiles in SN2 reactions. Because once you put one alkyl group on, it gets more basic. So it's easier to put the next group on, which means it gets more basic, which means it's even easier to put the last group on. But that's a story for next quarter. There's our primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary amines. Let's start with a primary amine and see how it reacts with an aldehyde or ketone. Before I do that, let me give you a little backstory. Why am I mentioning the fact that amines are bases? Because some textbooks go into a lot of fuss about the fact that the ideal pH for the reaction I'm about to show you is pH 5. Neither that acidic, but certainly not basic at all. Why is it that it's not, why does it not work well if you go below pH 5, which means you go to more acidic conditions? Well, why would amines in general not perform the way that you might expect them if you put them in acidic conditions? They're bases. So if you put an amine in an acidic medium, here's the point I'm trying to make. It's a base. If it was around HCl, then you'd end up with the salt. Which, if you go home and look at some of the back of your over-the-counter medications this evening, if you see blah, 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 dot HCl on your medication, then exactly this process has been done to it. Because a lot of medications have nitrogens in them, but a lot of medications are fat soluble. Well, if you're eating and drinking things that's going to have a lot of water in it, maybe it makes it difficult for something fat soluble to go along the ride to make it in your stomach to actually get absorbed to be useful medicine. So you might start out with something that's instead more water soluble. Well, how can you make something more water soluble? Turn it into a salt. So if you have a compound that's got a nitrogen as a main functional group, react it with HCl, you make the salt, which once you ingest it, it eventually could get deprotonated again and get into the bloodstream. Again, a little bit of a side story, but still. Try it. Go home and look and see if you have anything that has that dot HCl afterwards. And then this is the situation that you're in. Well, part of the reason to tell that story is nitrogen is nucleophilic if it's a base. As soon as it gets protonated, can a protonated amine be a nucleophile? What does nucleophile mean? Seeks positive charge. If you already got a positive charge, it ain't going to look for another one. Point of all of this is that we're going to be trying to attack a carbonyl. And the reason this mechanism's a little different is because nitrogen's a base. And so we, in theory, can show it attacking the carbonyl even without the carbonyl getting protonated. However, the carbonyl needs to get protonated, or the reaction won't continue past that point. And that's why we can't do this in a basic environment. You need a little bit of an acid around. So, let me just write this statement down that the ideal pH is 5. Based off of your scared looks, I'll let you go read up over this over the weekend, and then I'll talk again about all this pH and acid base and nonsense later. But ideal pH for the following reaction is pH 5. Now, since we're on the topic of acids and bases, though, someone in section 1-2 asked the following. A Grignard reaction, which we were doing in the context of protecting groups. He said, okay, I can see that protecting groups, taking them on and off, that's reversible. Is a Grignard reaction reversible? No. Because a Grignard reagent, again, has a conjugate acid that has a pKa of about 50 or 60. Once it attacks a carbonyl and pushes the carbonyl open, you have an alkoxide,
whose conjugate acid has a pKa of 16 to 18. So rounding the numbers off, 60 versus 20, you could say. Really strong base, not anywhere near as strong a base. So you're going from strong base to weak base, that's favorable. Reverse Grignard reaction would be from weak base to strong base. Doesn't want to happen. An alkoxide can't kick, normally, a carbon-carbon bond open. We'll learn exceptions next quarter. But no, Grignard reactions normally not reversible. I'll be covering that again next week because we need to talk about carbonyl reactions in general and about their reversibility or irreversibility. Getting to the point, let's see that reaction of a primary amine and a ketone. So the one difference, it's not the regular protonate-open-tacti-protonate cycle, although I could argue it's still valid. Usually this reaction is shown this way. Attack the carbonyl first, because a nitrogen is nucleophilic. Notice that although this looks like a base reaction, and I've already said earlier in the quarter that often anionic or basic reactions are irreversible. This one is reversible. Now, after that initial attack, we're going to have two events occur. We've made an ammonium salt, which is going to get deprotonated, and we have an alkoxide that's going to get protonated. And they're really quite next door to each other in this case, so maybe it might be possible to have an intramolecular deprotonation. But I'm not going to write it that way. And so if I don't write it that way, which is probably going to happen first? Is the deprotonation or the protonation going to happen first? Well, the answer is yes. What I really mean is it doesn't matter. One happens, the other happens. The main point is if it's not intramolecular, it's not simultaneous. This is very unlikely for both of those things to happen at once. So I'll show the protonation happening first, which since this is pH 5, it's still okay to use H+. Something I'm going to keep reminding us is that no H+ exists in base and no OH- exists in acid. So be careful of mixing conditions. But this is acidic, so it's okay to use H+. After the alkoxide gets protonated, then we have the deprotonation of the ammonium. Oops. Need to show it first. And at this point, we're halfway there. And so just like when you're halfway to a ketal or acetal, there's a special name for that intermediate. The name for this one is carbinylamine. It's got an alcohol-ish name in it and then the amine name in it at the same time. Just like in the hemiacetal and ketal cases, this normally is not isolatable. It normally will keep on going or it will revert back where we came from. Now, yeah, if you look at this, you might say, wait a minute, shouldn't that nitrogen get protonated before the oxygen because nitrogen's more basic than oxygen? Yeah, but then you really would just be going in the reverse reaction. And if you force these reaction conditions, if you remove water, for example, you will continue forward in the reaction. So that's what I'm going to show now. Oxygen gets protonated. And this is, this part of the mechanism you can abbreviate with that PODE mnemonic, because you protonate the OH group, that water opens up and leaves. We do have an attack, but here's where the reaction's different from using alcohols. When we used an alcohol or water, yes, I'm sorry. I think two carbons are missing.
One. There we go. Thank you.
What was I saying? Oh, yes. At this equivalent point in the mechanism, if we were using an alcohol, right at this point, a second alcohol would come in to attack. But intramolecular processes are usually more rapid than intermolecular processes. Something going on in a molecule is often faster than between two molecules. Especially in this case, what I'm about to show you, because this is nothing more than resonance. That resonance with an oxygen in the equivalent point of the mechanism would not be favorable. Because if you could picture it, you'd end up with an oxygen that's got a double bond to one carbon, a single bond to another carbon. Neither one of them, you can't keep both of them at the same time because you'd have a positively charged oxygen. So oxygen would never want to make this resonance structure and stay this way. But for nitrogen, when that resonance structure occurs, there's a hydrogen which can easily deprotonate. And when it does, we end up with a neutral molecule, which can be perfectly isolated. This is called an imine. Imine is whenever you have a carbon-nitrogen double bond. And just to warn you, we're going to have amines, imines, enamines, amides, and imides. So if you don't have enough A or M words coming, you will. And you do need to know all these different functional groups from each other. That's an imine. That's what we get from a primary amine. How about we see what happens with a secondary amine now? Shall we? So same substrate I'll use. Butane-2-one. And I'm going to skip part of the mechanism because it's identical. So I'm writing a couple arrows here just to mean I'm skipping showing you the steps. But I'll get to the same halfway point, the carbonyl amine. So if you reviewed the mechanism from the first part, you'd recognize that overall, what happens? The carbonyl opens up and you add a hydrogen to oxygen. The nitrogen adds in, you lose a hydrogen from nitrogen. All right, now let's continue from there. The next thing would be for the alcohol to get protonated. Water leaves. And now we got an issue. Because now we have a nitrogen that would be in the same situation as oxygen would be. Meaning that if we allowed the resonance structure to occur, we're going to end up with something that has a positive charge on nitrogen that can't be relieved in any way. So this kind of intermediate is not normally isolatable. And it's not favorable because yes, nitrogen can handle having a positive charge, but we have a carbon-nitrogen double bond that in response to that positive charge could open. And that's why something else happens instead. The something else that happens is that a base, which could be another molecule of that amine, can come along, pull a hydrogen off, and cause elimination. And so we get not a carbon-nitrogen double bond, but a carbon-carbon double bond next to the nitrogen. Now, last quarter when we saw something like this with alcohol, where we had an alcohol on an alkene, what do we call that functional group? An enol. Now that we have an amine instead of an alcohol, what do you think this is probably called? Well, instead of enol, it's enamine. Another one of your ene words. One of these quarters I should throw in amines, imines, enamines, and edamame and see if someone notices. M&M's, there we go. And I could get M&M's with chemical reactions put on them because you can custom order M&M's, so that would be cool. Yeah, if you didn't know that, a cool trick to do for someone's birthday is you can custom order images on M&M's now. So, now, why didn't this enamine form with a primary amine? Well, we're kind of out of time for me to tell that part of the story. But that's something for you to read up over the weekend then. Why didn't this reaction occur with a primary amine? Why did it take a secondary to get the enamine? Any questions before we wrap up for today?